Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc forum called The Federal Circuit's Reliance on One-Word Affirmances Under Rule 36. Is it Lawful? Speaking with us today, we have Joe Cinfrani of Friedland Cinfrani and Amit Vora of Kasowitz Benson Torres. And moderating the discussion, we have Robert Rando, who is a partner at Greenspoon Martyr. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. At the end of the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, you can enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Robert, thanks for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Edith. Good afternoon. I'm Rob Rando, a member of the Federalist Society's IP Executive Committee and a partner at Greenspoon Martyr in New York. First, I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for the opportunity to moderate today's forum. The question whether the Federal Circuit's reliance on one-word affirmances under Rule 36 is lawful is important and raises several serious issues. In addition to Rule 136 one-word affirmances, potential due process and constitutional issues, when viewed in the context of those affirmances of appeals from agency rulings, it presents serious issues regarding the tension between congressional grant of agency autonomy and the limit on that autonomy fostered by judicial review, statutory mandate, the integration of individual provisions of a statute with respect to congressional intent and judicial independence in its procedural rules, and the practical consequences of the ruling one way or the other. Before we get into any of those issues and the panel discussion, I'd like to set the stage with a reminder of the language of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure 36 and specifically as well, JAFC Rule 36. Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 36 provides entry of judgment and notice. A, entry. A judgment is entered when it is noted on the docket. The clerk must prepare, sign, and enter the judgment. One, after receiving the court's opinion, but if settlement of judgment form is required, after final settlement, or two, if a judgment is rendered without an opinion as the court instructs. B, notice. On the date when judgment is entered, the clerk must serve all parties a copy of the opinion or the judgment if no opinion was written, and a notice of the date when judgment was entered. Federal Circuit Rule of Practice 36 provides entry of judgment. A, judgment of affirmance without opinion. The court may enter a judgment of affirmance without opinion, citing this rule, when it determines that any of the following conditions exist and an opinion would have no precedential value. One, the judgment, decision, or order of the trial court appeals from is based on findings that are not clearly erroneous. Two, the evidence supporting the jury's verdict is sufficient. Three, the record supports summary judgment, directed verdict, or judgment on the pleadings. Four, the decision of an administrative agency warrants affirmance under the standard of review in the statute, authorizing a petition for review, or five, a judgment or decision that is entered without an error of law. Also goes on to note that this court does not prepare separate judgments for dispositive orders issued without an opinion. Instead, the court's dispositive order also serves as a judgment. Bearing this in mind, I'd like to introduce our wonderful panelists for today's discussion. Mr. Amit Vora is an appellate litigator at Kasowitz Benson Torres in New York. Prior to his current role, he was an assistant solicitor general for the New York Attorney General's office, where he defended the state and appealed before the New York Court of Appeals, the Second Circuit, and the U.S. Supreme Court. Before that service, he was a supervising attorney and fellow for the appellate court's immersion clinic at Georgetown and was a member of Covington and Burling's appellate practice group. He clerked on the First Fifth Circuit for Judge Ed Prado, and he graduated from Harvard Law School and Yale University. Next, we have Joe Cinfrani. Joe has a bachelor's and a master's degree in electrical engineering. After graduating law school in Virginia in 1997, Joe clerks for the highly respected Federal Circuit Court of Appeal judge, retired Judge Arthur Gayasa. Since then, he has been a patent litigator in Southern California for nearly 30 years, great weather, Joe, where he's currently a partner at Friedland, Fee & Franey. Now, Amit, since you have been intimately involved with the petition for cert in Park Vision versus TLC Industries, would you please lead us off with our discussion concerning Rule 36?
No problem, Rob. Thanks so much for that introduction and for setting the table. And now I come at this from the perspective of a general appellate litigator. Rob and Joe are preeminent members of the patent bar, and I am a newish member of the patent bar. And I can tell you that although the Rule 36 issue is well known to patent attorneys and stakeholders in the patent system, it's flown on the radar when it comes to just appellate attorneys generally. When I tell a fellow appellate attorney that if you're litigating before the Federal Circuit, there's about a 40% chance that the court will issue a Rule 36 judgment instead of an opinion, they're blown away. They're shocked that the Federal Circuit utilizes this summary affirmance mechanism as often as it does. To give you the precise numbers, I'm going to share my screen here. Hopefully this works. Okay, hopefully you're now seeing a table of Federal Circuit statistics, and you'll see that last year in 2024, the Federal Circuit issued about 484 opinions, but then did a Rule 36 judgment in 127 of those. And I think it's particularly important for our purposes to note that the Federal Circuit issued 94 opinions and appeals from the PTO. So these are appeals from the administrative agency. And then 71 Rule 36s in appeals from the PTO. And so the relative Rule 36 rate when you're an appellant appealing from an administrative decision to the Federal Circuit is about 40%. And that's pretty high, especially if you're a patent holder who, for example, has just been deprived of vested property rights in already issued patents through IPR. There's a 40% chance that the Federal Circuit might affirm that patent invalidation without giving you any explanation why. And as a result, that patent holder is left without patents and has never been given any judicial explanation for that deprivation, because all you've had so far is a agency decision by the PTAB and then a Rule 36 by the Federal Circuit. So how do we get here? Well, I want to take you back to 1929. So before the Federal Circuit, as many of you know, patent appeals were heard in the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals. But before that, they were heard in a court called the Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia. This court no longer exists. It didn't turn into the D.C. Court of Appeals or the U.S. Court of Appeals or the District Court, D.C. Circuit. It operated from 1893 to 1934. It's gone. Now, at that time, that court had a lot to do. The docket was congested. But the Court of Customs Appeals had little to do. So Congress thought, well, you know, we have this huge patent docket that the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia is having to deal with. Why not transfer all the patent cases to the Court of Customs Appeals and allow that court to sort of become expert in patent law? It would be nice to have a court that heard primarily patent appeals with a few customs appeals here and there, but primarily patent appeals. And that way, that court can really develop this specialized expertise. And you see that in the legislative history. You see that in comments from around the time. Here's one good example. So a 1932 article says that, tedious or not, the march of national progress in the arts depends on sensible construction of patent laws by the patent office and the appellate judicial tribunal. So from the get-go, there was this sense that we need the specialized court an integral part of that understanding, though, this recognition that we need a specialized court, is that we need the court to actually explain its reasoning. We need the court to provide opinions to clarify patent law, to unify it, to make sure that inventors understand whether or not what they're inventing is going to have patent protection, and so that investors can know what's worth investing in. So we really needed a more stable property rights foundation for investment in innovation. And that's what Congress was going for in creating the CCPA. And so you see that it actually explicitly required the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals to issue an opinion in every case. So that was so baked in, that was woven in to the tapestry of the CCPA. It's foundational to its objective. And the CCPA cleaved to that congressional directive, so much so that at one point in the, when you get to the 1970s, when the CCPA is still around, other appellate courts throughout the nation had been experimenting with docket management tools to make it easier to deal with their congested dockets and get through their cases. And other circuits were issuing Rule 36 type affirmances. But Judge Giles Rich of the CCPA was so against this very idea, so against the notion that on one particular case, he distributed this sarcastic draft affirmance to his fellow panelists on a pending appeal. And he says right here, he's like, is this an opinion within the meaning of the statute? And he posed that sarcastically. The answer to him is no. And in his view, it was just such a time waster. It seems like an efficient mechanism, but at the end of the day, as he says here, my fellow panelists, could you have reached a decision to approve or disapprove in a shorter time if I had actually given you an analytical reasoned opinion? Now, as we move from the CCPA to the federal circuit, I mean, it became even more important when Congress wanted to form the federal circuit to establish a court that rendered opinions in every case, or at least in some cases, especially in cases where there was an appeal from the patent agency. And so what Congress did is in Section 144 of the Patent Act, it says that upon its determination, the court shall issue to the director its mandate and opinion. Now, Section 144 doesn't use the same language as the prior statutes that apply to the CCPA. It's more efficient in implementing this reason-giving directive. But the word opinion is shorthand for a statement of reasons. That's a longstanding legal term of art. And how do we know that Congress was imposing a reason-giving directive when it enacted the statute and was sort of reviving the same directive that had applied to the CCPA? Well, we know that because the person who introduced this language was none other than Chief Judge Markey of the CCPA. And he, over and over again, when he was on the CCPA, said that every case has to have an opinion. And then when he moved to the federal circuit, he continued to say that every case has to have an opinion. Some are published, some are not. And then unpublished ones might be shorter. They might be directed only to the parties, but they'll still give the parties a sense of the reasoning. Now, today, we have a different federal circuit. The federal circuit, as we know, and as Rob and Joe will explain, doesn't adhere to the principles that Chief Judge Markey and Judge Rich were really committed to when they were on the CCPA and the fledgling federal circuit. In fact, around 1989, the federal circuit promulgated Rule 36, but it was controversial from the get-go. And in around 1995, at an annual conference of the federal circuit, Chief Judge Archer was actually forced to publicly explain why the court was using Rule 36 and how that could comport with the statutory reasoning governing requirement. And he says, well, I mean, I need to address whether the requirement of 35 U.S.C. 144 to issue a mandate and opinion is satisfied when we use Rule 36. And in his view, that Rule 36 judgment is an opinion. And I think there's a strong argument that it's not. It's not the sort of opinion that Chief Judge Markey and Judge Rich had in mind, or that Congress had in mind when it created the Federal Circuit or when it created the CCPA. So there's some historical background that I'll turn it over to Joe. And let me stop sharing the screen.
Thanks, Amit. You have really studied this historical background to the degree that few probably have. I come at it from a different perspective. One is in three ways, actually. One is I clerked at the Federal Circuit back in 1990, gosh, a long time ago. Let's just leave it at that. And I've also been a practitioner at the Federal Circuit, and I've had Rule 36s issued against me, and I've had Rule 36s issued for me. And so I've seen it from a number of perspectives. I'll try to address it from each one. The premise of our topic today is it legal? And so I think it's important to separate the Section 144 argument from the overall Rule 36, because Rule 36 is actually a FRAP rule that we read at the beginning. And it basically, the FRAP Rule 36 says, if no opinion is issued. So I think that it's established that no opinion needs to be written in the generic case, right? That's under FRAP. That was it from 1967. And it's been challenged a number of times, I think, in the Supreme Court, unsuccessfully so far. But I don't think anyone has quite made the arguments that you're making, Amit. So I can't wait to see what they do with your petition on that. So I think it's important to separate, is Rule 36 a good idea in the abstract or in the generic case, from is it required by Section 144? And so starting with the first part of that, I do think that Rule 36 serves a useful docket management and efficiency role. Well, let me start off with, we live in a world of limited resources. Right? Wouldn't everyone love to have a 60-page opinion in every single case? Yes, of course we would. So we know that we can't have that, and the courts have to make some trade-offs. One of the trade-offs is, how long does it take to get your decision after your oral argument? And you know, there's you know, the workload of the court has to be allocated in certain ways, and I am presuming that the use of Rule 36 allows the Federal Circuit to get my decision out to me in 3 months or 2 months instead of 8 months. That's a benefit that we all get that Rule 36 in some way provides. So starting with the position that, yes, I agree with Judge Markey, and I agree with him that we should, it would be wonderful to have opinions in every single case. The question is it an efficient use of court resources? And what, you know, what could they be doing otherwise? So that's apart from, and maybe I should stop there and see where we agree and disagree before we jump into Section 144. Because in my general experience, it can't get, the judges are working super hard. That was my experience as a clerk, and it's my experience as a practitioner. It's not like you could say, just do more. They're doing a lot. And so maybe I'll stop there and let Amit comment on the first part. Is Rule 36 justified by the efficiency aspects? I think it is, but maybe we disagree there. Let's start there.
So Joe, those are great points, and I agree with you. And I apologize if the audience was hoping to see some like clash, but I agree. And I just need to be honest. I completely agree that judges are overburdened and overworked. When I was a clerk, I saw firsthand that judges work hard in this country and they're underpaid. Now, if there's a mechanism that can ease that burden and do so fairly in a way that comports with due process, then great. And I think Rule 36, as a general matter, it is fine, is lawful. Now, I think the question that I'm concerned with, though, is when you use Rule 36 in an appeal from the PTAB, because in that particular situation, what ends up happening is that a patent holder is deprived of a vested property right in an already issued patent, and then the federal, and then appeals to the federal circuit, and then the federal circuit affirms, and that patent holder then not as only lost the patent, but has no judicial explanation as to why that happened. Now, that I think is fundamentally unfair, and more importantly, for this legal discussion, violates Section 144. But if the Federal Circuit continues to use Rule 36 in other cases, especially in cases from the district court, I don't think that's problematic, because there, the appellant has the benefit of a judicial explanation. The district court has provided an opinion that lays out for the appellant's understanding what happened. And that opinion, that reasoning is provided by a court. And that's the key. I mean, sure, the PTAB provides a decision, but the PTAB panelists, whether you want to call them administrative patent judges or PTAB panel members, whatever their title is, they're not Article III judges. And that's a very important distinction. Now, when it comes to sort of using Rule 36 as a docket management tool in PTAB appeals, I don't think that requiring the Federal Circuit to issue opinions in that narrow category of cases would overwhelm the Federal Circuit, because as you remember from the first slide, we're talking about 69 Rule 36s in 2024 in PTAB appeals. So then the question becomes, well, if the Federal Circuit were required to write an additional 69 opinions per year, is that too much? If an opinion can be a paragraph or even a sentence, then I don't think it's too much. I mean, there might be opinions where the court could just say, see this other case that we just issued last week. All our reasoning is there. And if that does the trick, then so be it. At least the parties then have some understanding of why the court reached the decision that it did. So I don't think 69 is too much. And then if you look at IPR specifically, there were 57 Rule 36s in IPRs last year. I don't think that's too much. But saying that the Federal Circuit must issue an opinion in every case, like the Federal Circuit used to do and like the CCPA used to do, I agree that that is no longer required. So I know that Chief Judge Markey and Judge Rich had this ideal, and we should always strive for that ideal. And if we come short, if we come up short, that's okay. But at the very least, we must have opinions in PTAB appeals.
Before you go further, I'll try to lob a grenade at both of you on the docket management issue, and it's really from a practical perspective, right? When a client wants to take an appeal, they're convinced that the learned judge at the trial level got it wrong. And so getting a one-word affirmance on that appeal really leads to a lot of disheartened, it's bad enough to lose, but, disheartened clients, stakeholders. And I appreciate the point that it does promote efficiency, but as I always tell my associates, get it right rather than fast. What does either or both of you think about those considerations?
Well, I'll take this. Being on the receiving end of Rule 36s on occasion, yes, it is unsatisfying. But when you look at the requirements to issue a Rule 36, it has to be unanimous. It has to not add any precedential value to patent law. And when there's one of five requirements that you read at the beginning, The findings are not clearly erroneous. So I don't think it's not like Rule 36s are issued in close cases. They're issued where it's apparent from the decision below that it was correct. And the way I interpret a Rule 36, whether for me or against me, is the decision below was right. We adopt it, even though technically and legally it's not really being adopted. But that is your opinion. And so that's how I've approached Rule 36, even though it is unsatisfying to not feel like your arguments were heard and considered by the appellate court. I agree with you on that.
Amit, you want to add anything to that?
Sure. I think, Rob, to like pick up on what you're saying, there is an argument to be made that Rule 36 should just be avoided in all cases. And Charles Macedo in the Island IP petition has, which is pending before the Supreme Court, has made this argument, and it's an excellent argument. And I think it makes sense, because when a court, first of all, the Federal Circuit has said that in every case, and Joe knows this from experience, in every case, even in cases where it's issued a Rule 36, it's done the work. There's been an oral argument. The judges have conferred, they read all the briefs, they've discussed all the issues. So they've done 90% of the work. It's just that last 10% that they haven't done. Well, from that perspective, one could say, well, why not do that last 10%, especially when that last 10% is so critical to so many legal values that we hold dear in this country, like transparency, accountability, even accuracy. So the accuracy component is something that a lot of clerks and judges experience. When you sit down to draft an opinion or a bench memo in the case of a clerk, sometimes it just won't write. Sometimes it's the process of writing that makes you realize that maybe my decision, my judgment was wrong. And I mean, this just goes to how the human mind works. I mean, the human mind is not truth tropic. Our minds are not geared toward generating empirically true beliefs about the world. We have all sorts of mechanisms that we rely on to generate accurate judgments. And I think one of those would be intellectual humility, thinking deeply. And a very important one is writing. Writing allows you to clarify and refine your reasoning. And so if you go through the 90% of the case workup that the Federal Circuit does, but then skip that last portion, I think that last portion might have led you to a different judgment. And it's an important step not to skip. And if it ends up being just a two-line opinion, then that's fine. So I think there is an argument to be made that even apart from this statutory Section 144 argument, the Federal Circuit shouldn't be issuing as many opinions as it has been. And it's very different from what other appellate courts do, which I think, Rob, you've got some stats on that or a perspective on that.
Sure.
Well, and I mean, did when you were at the Fifth Circuit, did the Fifth Circuit not, you know, do property rights and issue Rule 36s? They have an equivalent rule, I understand. So do a number of other courts. Would Rule 36 not get used by those courts?
When I was clerking, we didn't use it in our chambers. The Fifth Circuit last year used it twice. And I believe was the only court other than the Federal Circuit to do it. So if you look at all the other appellate courts, they do have a Rule 36 mechanism in their local rules, but they rarely invoke it. If they're invoking it, it's once or twice a year, maybe up to 10 times a year in certain years. But it's never invoked at the rate and at the numbers that the Federal Circuit is invoking it.
Well, so let me ask you this. So if you get a three sentence, you would agree three sentences would be enough, at least under Section 144 as an opinion. What do you get from that? If the three sentences are, we agree with the PTAB judge that, you know, this patent claim was obvious. We agree with the PTAB judge for the reasons stated in their opinion, right? What benefit does that get us as a, if that's the direction that it's forced to go.
If the, yeah, that wouldn't be helpful. I think a helpful opinion would be engaging with the arguments on appeal. And if the opinion is just see below, then I mean, that's not helpful, but it's still more than a Rule 36. A Rule 36 isn't even see below. So the Federal Circuit has made clear that when we're issuing a Rule 36 affirmance, we're not saying that we're adopting all of the reasoning of the PTAB. All we're saying is that we're adopting the bottom line. So then the parties are still left in the dark about what portions of the PTAB's reasoning apply and don't apply. This raises all sorts of confusion when it comes to collateral estoppel. Parties can strategically use whatever part of the PTAB opinion benefits them, and no one really knows what issues precluded and what's not. So, I mean, if the court were to say, see the opinion below, we adopt it in full, that's still more than what Rule 36 is doing. That's still helpful. Optimally, I think the court would provide, say, a paragraph of reasoning, but I'm not saying that that's necessary. I'm saying that that would be sufficient. And I think a good model would actually be the New York Appellate Division. So I'm a New York appellate attorney. I've been an assistant solicitor general for New York State. And so I'm familiar with the New York State appellate system. And a lot of us here in New York know that the appellate divisions, the first and second departments, won't give you an opinion like the Second Circuit will, where it goes on for pages and it has very detailed analysis of precedent and all the reasoning is spelled out. It'll usually be a paragraph. And sometimes that's frustrating, but at least you know like where the court was going and you have a sense of why you lost. Something like that, I think, would be fine. So a per curiam unpublished opinion, that's a paragraph, I think would be doable and would be beneficial and make a difference.
And along those lines, I have seen even some recent opinions from the Federal Circuit, maybe not a paragraph, but I've seen them, you know, 5-6 pages long, 3-4 pages long, where it just sort of generally goes through the reasoning and explains why the district court or the PTAB was right. And so I do agree with you that it would be nice, you know, obviously as practitioners, we want to see, okay, what did I get wrong? Or you want to see the judge agreeing with you, actually. But just as a practical matter, you're right. A couple of paragraphs, or even one paragraph, probably wouldn't be super difficult. And I understand Judge Michelle has had some comments on this, and it'll be hard to get me to disagree with Judge Michelle on almost anything. So,
well, yeah, along those lines, Judge Michelle has stated that the Federal Circuit's regular practice of issuing judgments without opinions and appeals from PTAB reviews contravened the literal terms of Section 144 of the Patent Act, which contained no exception that warrants immediate Supreme Court scrutiny, close quote. And he's not alone. Retired Judge O'Malley believes that in the context of IPR appeals, that the CAFC should provide greater oversight and ensure that the rationale for its stamp of approval is clear. Do either want to disagree with that?
Well, so I'll give you the counter. I'm not sure I'm convinced of the counter, but I'll give it to you, and then Amit can shoot it down. That it's the transmit argument from what I've read, and that is that Section 144 says the court shall issue to the director its mandate and opinion, and the argument goes that that does not require an opinion to be written, and in fact, Amit had the statute that governed the CCPA where they said, yes, every decision shall have an opinion. So Congress clearly knew how to tell courts you must issue an opinion in every case. When we get to Section 144, it can be interpreted to say that if there is an opinion written, it shall be sent to the PTO director. And so I turn the floor over to Amit to tell me why that argument is wrong.
So thanks, Joe. And I've seen that argument too. And I think this is all the more reason for the Supreme Court to take the case, because there is this back and forth in the scholarship. It's a meaty legal issue. And there have been student notes about it. There have been articles by professors about it. And then there's an article that does make the argument that you set forth. I think where this argument goes wrong, though, first, as a textual matter, it runs into the predicate act canon. If a statute says the Federal Circuit must issue an opinion to the PTO director, that means it must issue an opinion. That the act of issuing an opinion is a predicate of the act of issuing an opinion to the PTO director. As Scalia and Garner say in their treatise, Reading Law, in their chapter on the predicate act canon, I mean, it's only a two-page chapter, and they say this is just common sense. There's really not much need to explain the predicate act canon. But I think more importantly, the mandate and opinion language, as the legislative history shows, came from none other than Chief Judge Markey. And I think that's critical here. He, of all people, understood that there's a difference between a decision and an opinion, and the word opinion is packed with meaning. In addition, the Federal Circuit itself doesn't even buy this transmittal theory, because, as I mentioned, in 1995, Chief Judge Archer addressed publicly, does 35 U.S.C. 144 require us to issue an opinion in a PTAB appeal, and does Rule 36 comport with that requirement? So they took on the question. That framing, I think, undermines the notion that this is just a transmittal requirement. I mean, the Federal Circuit and Chief Judge Archer decided that Rule 36 judgments are opinions. So I disagree with that. And I think if you really look into the history of the word opinion, and I mean, there's the old soil canon, if you really consider like all the centuries of common law that really infuse that word with a particular meaning, I don't think you can say that a Rule 36 judgment is an opinion. But the fact that he asked the question in the way that he did shows that not even the Federal Circuit thinks that this is a mere transmittal requirement.
Well, so then let me ask you this. I mean, the Federal Circuit's Rule 36 came in 1987, somewhere like a long, long time ago. The Federal Circuit issued its version of the FRAP Rule 36. And other than Judge Archer with the comment that you had a second ago, there hasn't really been a lot of discussion. It's not like, oh, you can't do that. Where'd that come from? That violates Section 144. It's only sort of in the recent couple of years that this has come up. And it seemed like this issue had been settled for a long, long time up until now. What do you think the reason that it's coming up now as opposed to in 1990, 1991, all those?
Yeah, that's a great point. So the date that we've found is around 1989, and it's unclear why it was implemented. And that's one of the issues here, that there's just a lot of unanswered questions. Some have speculated that it might have been to help the Federal Circuit manage a bunch of appeals that arose from striking air traffic controllers who had just been fired by President Reagan. But it's unclear. In any event, 1989, the late 1980s is the date that we found. It did provoke alarm and cause controversy from the get-go. You see these annual conferences in the early 1990s, 1992, and then 1995, where members of the patent bar are complaining about this rule and are saying that at least when it comes to patent appeals, the court shouldn't be using this. But it really started to catch steam and really, you know, take over the patent community as an issue, as this hot issue after the AIA. Because then you ended up in a situation where you have IPR, which, as Judge O'Malley has publicly stated, is suspect when it comes to due process. And so you'll have an IPR where a patent holder loses a patent and then Rule 36 is applied. And that just, I think, really is a controversial use of it and caused people to look more closely at the sort of the legal basis and foundation for this rule. So you're right, there is sort of a counter argument would be, well, it's been on the books for this long. Why are you complaining now? Should have complained before. I don't know if that's sort of like a equitable ashes type of counter argument, but I mean, I think if it was unlawful then, it's unlawful now, and it really is a bigger problem now because of the interaction with IPR. And there's also this sort of constitutional avoidance canon argument that comes into play now that it might have not have applied in the 1980s. Now you have a situation where if you don't have that Federal Circuit oversight, if you don't have the Federal Circuit issuing an opinion when it affirms a PTAB, then you have, or when it affirms an IPR, well, then you have like oil states, which says that IPRs are okay with in terms of Article 3, but which left open the question of whether IPRs comport with due process. And I mean, there's an argument that to compensate for the due process shortcomings of IPRs, the Federal Circuit should issue an opinion. And if we're not issuing an opinion, then that makes IPRs unconstitutional from a due process perspective.
Yeah, I'd like to follow on that too. Notwithstanding the statutory issue that play in part provision, which is seemingly clear, the employment of Rule 36 for any patent appeal inheres great significance in light of the various instabilities in the patent law and enforcement mechanisms, whether it's the constant need for SCOTUS to resolve AIA statutory or PTAB procedural questions, the lingering issue of 101 patent eligibility, and the never-ending efforts by Congress and stakeholders to correct those instabilities. Rule 36, one word affirmances do nothing to ameliorate these problems, nor advance the ball.
Yeah, I'd hate to base the legal argument on I wouldn't call it instability in patent law, but there are open questions. If we've gotten any message from the Supreme Court in the last 20 years, it's patents, you're not special. You're just like every other area of law. And I would think that there are property rights being decided in other circuits via Rule 36 that are just as important as the patents. The one thing I will note about the IPRs, Amit, is those opinions are 70, 80 pages. Those are some of the most thorough opinions you're ever going to find from an agency, I think. I guess the reasoning is there. I think what you're arguing in it is, I would just like to see the Federal Circuit put their stamp on it and say, yeah, we agree with that, as opposed to not, you know, have the parties question, okay, what was it that got me affirmed? Yeah.
And I think the other issue is the administrators who are issuing that decision in an IPR are not Article 3 judges. We call them administrative patent judges, but they're not judges. And there's a difference between an Article 3 judge rendering an opinion and providing that oversight and a PTAB panel member issuing its reasoning. I think that oversight is necessary. And although the Supreme Court, you're right, has said that Federal Circuit, you're not special. And I think that principle is correct when we're looking at the Federal Circuit and we're asking whether it should abide by the typical rules that apply to other courts and whether it should abide by congressional statutes. But it is special in one respect. I mean, we have one appellate tribunal, one court in this country that's supposed to sort of develop, clarify, and unify the law in one particular area. So it's all the more important for that court to be issuing opinions and providing reasoning. And as I mentioned before, that was the purpose of transferring jurisdiction from the District Court of Columbia Appeals to the CCA, which became the CCPA. And that was the purpose of the Federal Circuit. So if there's one court that should be issuing opinions more often, I think it would be the Federal Circuit.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take it a step further with, you know, pushback on us not being so special, right? I mean, it occurs to me that there's a bit of irony in that Rule 36 one-word affirmances are used in appeals of patent cases exclusively heard by the CAFC and are arguably or can be arguably among the most complex litigation in federal courts and also have arguably the greatest impact on the U.S. economy and to a great extent, national security. Yet a vast majority of the other circuits do not even employ the same rule in the other cases within their jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I should clarify, I didn't mean that the Federal Circuit wasn't special. So they're certainly special. You know, it's a court of exclusive jurisdiction over patents. I interpreted a lot of the Supreme Court decisions over the last 20 years as patent law. You're like every other area of law, and we're going to treat you like every other area of law. For example, like eBay, injunctions, and things like that. Yeah.
Well, we could try to fix that too, but... Well, you know, there's, speaking of commentators and stakeholders on this issue, my good friend Charlie Macedo of Amson Rothstein, who filed the petition in Rule 36 Island Intellectual Property case concerning the affirmances of Rule 56 summary judgment, has pointed out that the district court opinions which lack adequate grounds or reasoning for decisions are routinely rejected by appellate courts. You know, so there can be an argument there, right? What good for the goose should be sourced for the gander. Any thoughts?
Well, I guess I take Amit's point that the PTAB decisions are not being issued by Article III judges. And that seems to be a dividing issue for you. Not so much whether, you know, patent rights or property or whether there's special form of property. I think of it, your point is that there's a difference between Article III judges and administrative law judges. And that makes the difference to you on some of this?
Yeah, I think that's a critical distinction that... At some point along the way, there should be at least one Article III judge who has said something. And if you end up with an IPR plus a Rule 36, that you're going to end up with a patent holder who's received no explanation from any Article III judge. And that's a big problem. That's a statutory violation. But even outside of that context, I do think it's important for... the Federal Circuit to provide its reasoning and go through the process because the process of opinion writing really does refine reasoning and could result in a different outcome than if you were just to rubber stamp the decision.
Well, certainly I can agree with you that the process of writing briefs in my experience certainly tends to refine your focus and things like that. So I agree with you that the process of writing certainly tends to hone your reasoning on those things.
Yeah, I think an adjunct to that too is my experience. You know, with oral argument, that I find often judge or judges are really playing devil's advocate with themselves to really reinforce their own opinion. And I think along the lines of what you just said, you know, in actually committing, writing it down, you can still, you know, it gives you the opportunity to continue to play devil's advocate with your own, to sharpen your opinion.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I actually want to share my screen once more, if that's okay. I just want to show you. We found this little fascinating article from 1932 where a commentator, George II, was describing the CCPA. And it was just so striking because he says that the CCPA avoided rubber stamp decisions. They went through and they provide a reasoning. And they also mentioned that the court really provided this oversight and this sort of corrective function. They say that there's a lot of reversals of the patent office to correct any possible tendency, the part of that office toward a narrow view of what amounts to an invention. And I think a lot of patent holders today are frustrated with a process where the PTAB will, for lack of a better term, kill their patents. And then the Federal Circuit will affirm that decision. In fact, the statistics are alarming. You'll see that in over 80% of PTAB final decisions, the entire patent is invalidated. In over 70% of PTAB final decisions, at least one claim is invalidated. And then you move over to the Federal Circuit and you see that the vast majority of the time, the Federal Circuit is affirming those PTAB invalidations and then doing so under Rule 36. So that, I think, is a problem. And at the very least, the Federal Circuit, if it's going to do that, should abide by the statute. And I actually see there are some questions here in the Q&A tab. And one of the questions is, why should courts be concerned with disheartened parties? And I love that. That's such a great question. Yeah, who cares if you're disillusioned or disheartened? And you're right, that alone doesn't matter. The argument is that it violates the statute. But if you want a policy reason or a reason beyond the statute for why the Federal Circuit should stop doing this, is that it really does add insult to injury or injury to injury. And dignity matters. That's a value that the law should be concerned with. And the parties are denied the dignity of a judicial explanation. But if you don't buy that, the statute tells you that you must write an opinion. And if that's all that matters to you, fine. Well, the Federal Circuit should abide by the statute.
Well, more importantly, I think, you know, the argument is that it runs afoul of the mission of the Federal Circuit being a consolidated avenue for appeals to help, you know, maintain stability in the patent law system, predictability that goes back to, innovators and investors. I'm not sure that it's very satisfactory to say that, you know, if in fact, you know, one of the paramount concerns is a docket management tool, I'm not sure that that answers the full question and is satisfying enough. There are ways, I believe, to achieve a compromise, maybe not, as you pointed out, Joe, you know, just a terse, well, we, you know, couple of sentences that say the same thing, essentially, we affirm because we affirm, but rather a little more meat on the bones. I think there is some kind of middle ground. Before we end this, I would like to maybe ask each of you your thoughts on whether at this juncture, you know, considering all of the concerns we have in the patent law community among stakeholders, and, you know, our never-ending quest for Congress to try to fix things, so to speak, over the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, and whatever thoughts you have on either side of the eBay decision. Do you think this is the time when the Supreme Court may grant these cert petitions? And if you do, why?
And let me ask you a follow-up to that, Robert. Are you talking about whether the Supreme Court would grant the cert petition pending in this it, but for this issue, or are you talking about on a number of we'll call it unsettled? I think they're settled, but some people would like them to be unsettled.
I'm sorry. I was focusing on Rule 36, and you know, in particular, Parker Vision and Island IP.
I I do think this is a good time for the Supreme Court to step in and address this issue. There's certainly been enough banter about it. It has certainly been an issue that has percolated over the last, say 8-9 years, something like that, that we've been handling IPR. So yes, it would be nice if the Supreme Court, they're going to have a busy docket this year, I think. But if they find time for this case, I wouldn't be upset.
Amit?
Yeah, I agree. I think the Supreme Court absolutely should grant review because this issue hasn't gone away. Parties have raised this issue before. In the past, Supreme Court has denied review, but parties weren't deterred by those denials. They kept bringing it up because it feels so wrong. And by the terms of the statute, it is so wrong. On top of that, I think in prior petitions, the history and the historical context of this statute wasn't set forth, but we've compiled the legislative history now in the Parker Vision petition for the 1928 statute, the 1948 statute, the 1982 statute creating federal circuit, and the 1984 statute, which adopted this mandate and opinion phrase from Chief Judge Markey. And it becomes clear that when Congress drafted the phrase mandate and opinion, had a particular purpose in mind. That purpose was one that is a century old now, which is the federal appellate court with patent jurisdiction should be issuing opinions in appeals from patent agencies. In those circumstances, a court needs to speak up. So I think with the benefit of this history and with the benefit of two former federal circuit judges now expressly supporting that position, I think it's a great time for the Supreme Court now to grant review in these cases.
And before I let that point go, I'm not necessarily agreeing that which way the Supreme Court should come out. I just wouldn't mind if they come in and settle the debate.
For sure. It's meaty enough for the court to grant review, and then we'll see which way it comes out. And that would be fitting because, the question here is whether the federal circuit should give reasons. Well, the Supreme Court should give reasons for why review isn't warranted.
Yeah, I'll just add that I agree with both of you on that point. And in the interest of full disclosure, I did file amicus brief in both Parker Vision and Island IP on behalf of the Association of Amicus Counsel. But I think the time is right, and I think it's necessary. But maybe someone from the Supreme Court might be listening. Let's hope. I see we have a couple more questions here. A simple one, Amit, how can we get a copy of the slide deck?
Yeah, I'll send that to you afterwards so people can see the slide deck for sure.
Great. Okay. Doesn't a one-word ruling signal that the court agrees with the reasoning of the previous court or decision-making body, and isn't that sufficient?
The answer is no. The Federal Circuit has explicitly said that when we issue Rule 36, we are not endorsing the reasoning. We are only endorsing the bottom line.
Okay. If there's a decision below, what extra work is there for the court to cut and paste it into a new decision? Here's a thought.
Yeah, that's similar to the prior question, though. If the Federal Circuit truly agrees with every word of the PTAB, then fine, see the decision below. But I doubt the Federal Circuit truly agrees with every word of a PTAB decision in the vast majority of these appeals.
And without speaking out of school, I do think there's a fair amount of work that goes into writing an opinion, even if you do agree with the decision below. I don't know that I necessarily agree that 90% of the work is done. Issuing an opinion that is consistent with prior opinions that addresses all of the issues, that's a big job.
Yeah, and I would agree too, Joe, that I'm not sure how much more you get from merely a cut and paste or affirmed.
Yes.
I'm not sure that it reflects reflection and consideration beyond that. But maybe that's just me. It appears that unless in closing, either you, Joe, or Amit, would you want to say anything in closing? We've been very efficient with time, but I'll open it up to either one of you for any last thought.
I'll just close by saying I hope the court grants review. That's all.
And my last thought would kind of go back to where I started, which is the judges and clerks are working hard. And so to say do more isn't satisfactory, because that means someplace has to do less, right? It's not an infinite amount of resources. And I, for one, do appreciate having decisions issued earlier and all of the efficiencies that may go with Rule 36.
Yeah, and I'll just say this, Joe, I agree with you. And I hope that none of my comments in any way imply to minimize the pressure, the docketing pressure that all the federal judges experience. The federal judiciary is doing God's work. Well, I definitely want to thank you, Amit and Joe. This has been a very enlightening discussion forum, and I'm hopeful that the audience also viewed it that way.
Rob, I just have to add, I agree with both of you. Judges work hard. 70 more paragraphs, I think, would be a fair ask.
Well, great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Joe and Amit for speaking with us today, and to Rob for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your active participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.